this is episode 12 of Security Views Radio. I am your host, Adam Slater, the John Wick of cybersecurity podcasting. It has been a minute. I'll be honest, it's been a little bit, but we're back. A couple things have sort of been kicking me into high gear a little bit, and I wanted to get in front of the mic again. I have a special guest with me today, John Stengel, and he'll hop in a minute here. But before we sort of get started with the interview, I wanted to talk a little bit about John. For those of you who don't know, John is actually the owner of JSCM Group, this company. He started it back in 2000. But before that, he was actually working and he helped manage several multi-million dollar IT departments. He was a security consultant for one of the largest P&C insurers out there. And throughout his entire career, and especially since he started up JSCM Group, he's focused a lot on training. As we all sort of know, the weakest link on your network isn't really any of the physical parameters or any of the services that you're using. It's always individual people. And so training has always been a cornerstone of JSCM Group and a cornerstone for what John wants to do. And so JSCM Group obviously has done a lot of security training, and John spearheaded that, training people from really all different businesses and, verticals, things like that, from retail, healthcare, finance, government, military, law enforcement, and so on. And sometimes this training has been a specific, for a specific product or maybe a specific service, but sometimes it's just been general cybersecurity knowledge and general cybersecurity best practices. But one of the things, this is sort of why I wanted to grab him today, was John's been working on this new, has been really touring with this new presentation. And it's about protecting children on the internet. And he's been giving this presentation to schools, churches, and organizations like that have open networks for families, and specifically for, when young people are on them. And he's been talking with them about how to best protect themselves and how to best protect these young people who we are responsible for when they're on our network. So I wanted to bring John in and talk a little bit about this presentation. And I had some questions for him. So we'll just sort of, this will be a little bit of free flowing, but we've got a couple major topics that I wanted to cover about his presentation, and we'll just sort of go from there. So, hey John, how you doing today?
Good. Thank you, Adam, for making a time for me today. I'm sure I pulled you out of something else that you thought was a little more fun to do than this, but after your time upstate, now that you're back.
now that I'm back in. Yeah, no, it's good. No, I did miss this, so it's good to be to do it again here. So the first thing, and the thing that jumped out the most to me about your presentation, and the first thing I wanted to ask about was one of the topics that you cover is how the brain actually acts a little bit different when you're using the internet. What's going on there? How does that happen, and what does that do?
So one of the things I talk about in the presentation, one of the things that really jumps out at people is I actually go back and I actually kind of define what our behavior is like while we're on the internet. And it's important to understand that, because without an understanding of what your brain does, it's really difficult to understand how a kid will react. But once you kind of understand how the brain works on the internet, then it's really easy to understand how that can be amplified in kids or teens. And the thing about on the internet, in the kind of the briefest way I can explain it, is that when you're on the internet, your brain mimics being intoxicated. Okay. There's actually what's called online disinhibition, which is a condition that exists online that allows people to do things they normally wouldn't do in public. Kind of picture yourself maybe visually, maybe after you've had four or five beers or Captain and Morgan's or whatever your drink of choice might
be,
Jack and Coke or whatever that might be. And you start to make decisions differently. I often notice that if you know, maybe I have a couple drinks at dinner, I'm probably more likely to get dessert than if I didn't get.
Yeah, I didn't have those drinks.
You're going to make decisions that you normally wouldn't make. Well, this behavior is actually amplified on the internet. People do things just like if they were impaired. And it's because there is no sense of rule. There's a sense of freedom that I won't get caught. I can't be seen. No one's going to pay attention to what I'm doing.
Right.
Now, how this affects kids is that in the real world, there are restrictions. If I'm going with my kids and we're out, I can say, don't jump on that. Don't cross the street. Don't yell at that person. Keep your voice down. We're inside. On the internet, there is no authority figure. There's nobody on the internet to say, hey, don't do that, or hey, that's not a good idea.
Okay.
So what happens is it actually gets a kid thinking that they have way more freedom than they normally would have. They feel like, hey, my parents aren't here.
Right.
I can do this thing. There's nobody telling me no. So maybe today they go an inch further or a couple clicks further than they would have before. And then every day they just go a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper. These things tend to amplify. So once you become a really young kid who doesn't understand what certain links are, or they hear a funny word and they want to go search what that word means,
sure.
And then they realize it, and then they look for videos about that word, or there's all kinds of little things out there. And plus, other friends are saying, hey, click on this link. Then you fast forward to teenage behavior, and you can get into some real, real trouble there. You get into trouble because of teenagers struggle with, you know, a lot of issues such as depression or eating disorders or certain other body image issues and stuff like that. Those behaviors, those concerns or those issues can actually only be amplified online.
Right. Yeah.
There's a weirdness that can exist where you can go on the internet and you can connect with anybody you want to connect with, and you can have that feeling of community, but that can also be flipped and it can also actually amplify a behavior.
Sure.
Really recent case, sort of related but sort of unrelated, was there was a kid, I'm trying to think of the state, but he wanted to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And his girlfriend was actually cheering him on in order to complete
this. Oh, yeah, I read about this, yeah.
The decision just came down. I don't want to get into the debate whether or not she should have been charged with manslaughter or not, but that just kind of goes to show you how certain behaviors can actually be amplified or encouraged,
yeah,
even if they're destructive.
You know, it's interesting, you know, being a person in their early 30s, I remember when I was young, being very young, being on the internet, there was this sort of thought that this was that you know, we sort of knew that behavior was there, and that people would say things and you know, on message boards or in chat rooms and interact with other people differently, and there was people that had this tendency to sort of sometimes be more abrasive, and we actually kind of thought that. That was because you were essentially anonymous. You know, no one signed up with their first, middle, and last name. But it's interesting now because so much of internet usage and social media and networking platforms and things like that, everyone's using their real names, but those behaviors still continued. So it's an interesting dynamic there. Where you are seeing, I think you're right, online disinhibition.
Disinhibition.
Okay. That's really interesting that managed to persist, because like I said, you know, way back when, you know, it was just you had your handle and that was it, but now people know your real name and they know, you've got your picture there. So
if you think about, to give an example of that, recently there was the shooting that took place with the senator, I believe, representative, I'm sorry, and the immediately after, we knew the guy's name, mm-hmm. And immediately after, his Facebook profile was public, and everybody could go read what this guy was saying.
Right.
That was very aggressive and very telling of what this guy was kind of in his mind. He felt comfortable to post that stuff publicly,
right,
way before he probably made the decision to, you know, go out there. So there's so much that people feel safe. There's this thought that it's private. mm-hmm. or that I'm your friend on Facebook so we can have this private conversation, but it's truly not, and people really just don't understand that. But I think that's a whole separate issue of people posting stuff they shouldn't post because of future employment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those kind of things. I mean, those things are obviously a concern for parents, a concern for kids. But the real issue is kind of has to get into, like, why do they feel safe? And the reason is because they feel there is absolutely no authority. There is nobody. There's no need. It's complete, you know, free choice out there.
Right, right.
And it truly is. You can, if you can dream it, you can find it.
Right.
And you will find you're not the only one. And that behavior can be truly, truly negative. It can also be comforting.
Right.
If you're a girl who wants to play football, you can find a community of girls who share that in a complete innocent way. But there's a flip side of that. And it really comes down to just, you're just, the brain cannot actually function at that age to understand right from wrong.
Interesting. So that, go back to something you sort of mentioned. You mentioned being able to find things and to find like-minded groups of people. There was something else that you mentioned in your, that you talk a pretty decent amount about in your presentation. And you talk about the dark web. I'm sure most of our listeners probably know what the dark web is. But just in case, typically based, sometimes it's referred to as the dark net, deep web, things like that. Basically it's the seedy underbelly that on the seedy underbelly that is the internet. It's where you can get a lot of, illicit and very, very often illegal, materials, whether that's, you know, images, videos, things like that. But it's also where you can go and you can, if you know how to get there, I guess you can purchase, you know, other illegal materials, drugs, weapons, things like that. You bring this up in your presentation, and I'm going to be honest, I don't even know how to get to the dark web to find these places. Like, I only know about sites like Silk Road because there was a big deal when it got shut down and it was in the news. You think kids and children, like how, but I've also never sought any of that kind of stuff out. Is that stuff really that easy to find?
Yeah, so first off, I call it the dark web because my true hope is that producers in Hollywood will name the next Spider-Man movie
Dark Web.
Dark Web. Or like an Arachnophobia 2.
Like, sure.
You know, like the spiders make a comeback kind of
right,
thing. But
right.
No, the dark web is just sort of the general term. Dark web, it's all the same thing.
Yeah.
And what we, the general thing that takes place on a dark web would be considered, I would say, crime as a service. So basically, like, you know, anything that is illegal that you want to purchase can be purchased and sold through there. Drugs, weapons, prostitution, child pornography, and even sex trafficking, which is a really big deal where we sit today in Charlotte.
Yes.
All can be purchased and bought online through that. There are sites like Silk Road. They're not the only ones.
Yeah.
They're not the only site out there. Of course, that one's shut down now. But there's many, many other sites out there where you can buy absolutely anything that you want. Drugs, whether illegal or legal drugs bought illegally. You know, like I say that.
Right.
There are legal drugs such as Adderall that can be purchased through these sites or Chinese made knockoffs of those kind of drugs or not necessarily. Just Adderall, but it's a number of drugs out there that can be purchased out there. So you may not know how to get to the dark web, but the interesting thing about it is that there are recruiters out there looking for kids to recruit them to come here to get on there. And there are tools and utilities that you use to get on this site.
Yeah.
It's accessed through certain types of routers called Tor routers.
Yeah, yeah, Tor
that,
browser.
That allows you to get to that. And there's a search engine for it called Grams. And the Grams search engine is what allows you to search for whatever you want in this illicit deep web that exists out there. And a lot of kids can find their way to this. And I'm not going to give you a percentage, but it's very, very possible for them in order to find their way out there in order to do that. The way currencies work out there, they're using Bitcoin and other things that are not traceable. They're not after taking credit cards.
Yeah.
I guess they'll take your credit card. You can also buy credit card numbers out there. But and so they're recruiting kids to get onto these sites because they can kind of pull them into that world, whether they can be I forget what the term is when you use somebody to ship a package to.
Like a mule or something.
Yeah, it's a mule. There's another name for it. Or trying to recruit kids into the prostitution rings and stuff like that. And there's a number of stories about that take place with high school kids, especially. So
wow. Yeah, so that's really interesting. I always sort of viewed that portion of the internet as, like I said, I never really interacted with it because I've never searched those things out. I've never, Googled how to sex traffic. So, like,
although you did know what Silk Road was, so I have to check your browser.
Yeah, well, I read the news, that was a big one, right? That was like one of the big ones.
It was one of the original mainstream kind of like eBays of crime or eBays of the deep web. It was like the big. It was the Amazon. It was the place where you would go. The main marketplace. It was just sort of like it's a historically significant place.
Right. Yeah. And so, like I said, I sort of always viewed it as a marketplace for things that I had no interest in, so I never went. But that's interesting that it's being used sort of as a recruitment tool.
And so all these sites, all these things, they're not hosted in this country. They're not American based things. They would be shut down pretty quickly. There's a lot of federal agents and stuff out there, but watching these things. But these things are hosted in other countries, but that doesn't stop anybody from getting there. The internet, of course, allows us to all be connected, which has this huge side effect of not being able to control, servers in other countries. And some countries do a good job of, kind of policing that. Other countries do not. It really just depends on that country's policies. So, and I think that you have to understand that there's different risks, basically based off the different age groups. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but I'm kind of like
a little bit, but it's fine.
No, I'm sorry, but so the risks are not the same. You're not looking necessarily. You're not going to recruit a kid to prostitution, when they're six. That's not, really what that market is for. They are going to recruit them for different things, to get them to install something on a home computer or to send them images of things that they might want to see when they get to be a little bit older, 10, 12, in that age group. So,
Okay. So, you did jump a little bit, but that's fine. One of the other things that you discuss is how to sort of try to corral or control online interactions for children in different age groups. Now, obviously, all kids are different, and so you it's impossible to sort of put an exact line, an exact date on. But in general, you talk about kids under 13 and then kids over 14 or over 13 and older, right? So with those two groups, what are you sort of looking at doing differently?
Well, first, I think that there's a little bit of an issue. I think that there's this idea, this notion out there that we need to get kids on technology as soon as possible, under the premise that it's needed. They have to be able to compete. We have to get them on technology.
Right.
I really disagree with that. We're seeing kids as young as 6 months being on smart devices and tablets and other devices. It's sort of an interactive babysitter type scenario.
Yeah.
Or just an interactive gameplay, thinking that it would kind of help them. And what actually we're showing is that device interaction too early actually increases the likelihood of ADHD. It increases the likelihood of the brain looking for constant change and constant feedback. So there's a lot of studies that have been produced about that and about how that's not necessarily a good idea. In fact, the American Pediatric Association says that no kid should be on a device until the age of 13.
Wow.
Which I find very interesting. And I find it humorous for a couple reasons. This is the American Pediatric Association saying that they shouldn't be on this device till 13. This is the same organization that says, hey, all these kids need to get these vaccines.
Right.
The schools only listen to the vaccine portion of the recommendation. They ignore the device portion of the recommendation. So I have seen kindergartners in my own family being on devices as part of their daily school.
Yeah.
And it absolutely infuriates me. It's like, I don't understand why you're on there. I don't understand why they need to be on that. I mean, I sit here today running a technology company who I can type and I have all the skills I need, and I didn't touch a device until probably eighth grade in school. I'm not saying I did it outside of school, but in school, it probably was eighth grade before they made me take a computer class, which was really a glorified typing class. So I don't think that the need needs to be there that we have to put these kids on these devices so early.
Okay.
Schools are doing their students a tremendous disservice by pushing these devices on these kids way, way too early without the proper controls in place. Many schools that we look at have the same controls in place for a kindergartner as they do for a 12th grader. There's absolutely no need for that level of engagement. You cannot turn a kindergartner loose on YouTube. There's tons of inappropriate stuff out there. And like for the flip side is a high school can see a little more stuff, but you may not want your high schooler seeing the entire
they shouldn't have free reign.
Entire free reign of the and plus why are schools paying for that bandwidth and that usage in order to do that? It's a whole big conversation. So they're not separating out the different groups. The younger the kid, the longer you can delay a kid on a device is proven by the American Pediatric Association to be better for that kid.
Okay.
And it does not delay their abilities to function in the world or to be able to learn.
Hmm.
There are certain kids who need IEPs or some type of certain educational plan in place that requires them to need additional stuff, such as they can't write because of maybe they're on the autism spectrum or what's called or ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and that they need a device in order to communicate. That to me should be the exception, not the rule of putting everybody on these devices, in my opinion. Now then you fast forward to when the kids are teens. Teens are subject to all kinds of other things. I mean, it's well known that gaming systems are recruitment tools for things like terrorists. Teens are also susceptible to something called the risk shift phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you feel that you're not alone. So, for example, if you're by yourself and you're walking through a shopping mall, the odds of you throwing a brick through one of the windows in a mall is like zero. You're probably not going to do that. You're there by yourself.
Right.
However, if you're with a group of 12 people and they're like, hey, man, throw the brick through the... You're more likely to do that because you're in a group.
Right.
So that risk shift takes place where you feel more comfortable because you're not alone. And that risk shift phenomenon can take place online because you're in a group. So everyone's doing it, so it's cool.
Yeah, it's sort of classic peer pressure.
Correct. It just takes place online, whether that's through their Snapchat apps or whatever they're using today versus or Twitter. I know the kids today don't really use Facebook, so it's sort of an irrelevant topic, but you know, most of those other types of things, those things can take place. And teens also have this whole other area to worry about because they're using apps for dating and some other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I for the life of me don't understand why a teen needs an app to date. I mean, there were plenty of guys to ask out girls when I was in school. I don't know why apps were definitely not needed, but apparently they're getting more popular. And I think that a lot of this, though, has to do with... I think parents, one of the reasons why I'm doing these talks is I don't think parents are aware of all these things. They assume because their kids have an app that it's okay because their friends are on it or that they need these things for school. And I really need to push back on that. I mean, other talks we've done, we always kind of do this follow-up and kind of say, hey, bring in your devices that your kids are using. Let's talk about that. Let's take a look. And I've seen things on there. I've seen it where a kid was using a Snapchat thing, and a dad's like, well, I have access. And then I clicked on this one section called For Your Eyes Only, and there was a password, and the dad did not know the password. Those things are scary for parents. You have to know what's going on and what are on your kids' phones. And so many things can be present on your kids' devices that you just don't allow. There's things that you would never allow in your house, but that device is allowing it into your house.
Right.
So I really want to get out there, and I'm trying to educate parents on these risks. And there's, you know, zero risk to bring me in to speak about it because I'm not charging for this. It is simply right. a way for us to give back. You know, as an organization, we have spent years testing schools, working with these different organizations, understanding kid behaviors. I always tell that I was blocking websites and doing traffic control in the 1990s when that was basically unheard of. In fact, the program we used was called Little Brother was the name of the program that we would install that would block web traffic. But
I hated Little Brother when I was in school. I know Little Brother, yeah.
Little Brother was really cool because you didn't need a proxy server, by the way, which was very
handy. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember occasionally I would try to goof off in class and go play a game somewhere and be like, no, Little Brother says you can't go.
Well, we need to find your school and give them an award for having that so early. Because a lot of people didn't have it back then.
Yeah.
And we'd notice all these behaviors, and we'd notice that the biggest porn problem was from the 63-year-old Betty in accounting because she had a friend who sent her stuff.
Right.
Click on, or you know, it's never who you expected. And
sure.
So the only thing that we learned very early on was the only thing is that you don't know what's going to happen. You have no idea who's doing what or what's going on, so you just simply, you know, don't assume anything.
Right.
And so, but over the years, we've built up more and more of relationships with schools and developed content filters, and we've kind of seen what's going on. We fought the tools kids use to bypass the web filtering that takes place. It's called proxy avoidance is a technical term, but these tools that you can plug into computers to bypass it.
Yeah.
And schools are not putting in the controls in many cases in order to block those things. I understand that there's outliers out there, and if anybody listening to this is one of those outliers, I commend you for taking those steps. However, the majority of the people we test, I assure you, are not taking the steps necessary. There are some things that are they're being done that makes it appear so, but give me 10 minutes and I'll show you how those filters can be bypassed. And kids know these things. There are websites that send kids daily emails saying, here's the bypass link of the day. Here's a tool that you can put on here. They're working harder than you are to block that traffic.
Right.
I was in a conversation today and we were talking about how often they back up their firewall. And they said, well, only when we make changes to it. The last time was probably the last time you guys were here, which was like 18 months
prior.
If that's the last time they modified their firewall, there's no way that school is secure. There's absolutely zero way that school is secure because the technology changes constantly. You know, we're constantly tweaking firewalls here as an organization. The tools are not static that these kids are using.
Right.
So I really, really want parents to understand that it's not just, you know, you can't look at kids as a whole. You have to look at kids in general and the different age groups. You have to take each one individually, treat them appropriately and age appropriate. I'm not saying that they shouldn't interact with their friends online. I'm saying just do it in a way that's very conservative.
That makes sense. I mean, I'll be honest, that pretty much covered the last major thing that I wanted to talk about. Thank you for coming in. And
go ahead and plug. You know,
please plug away.
If anybody's interested in us doing this talk or me doing this talk for your organization, I would love to have that conversation. So just reach out to us on the JSCMgroup.com website.
Yep.
And love to get that set up. I just want to get this message out there. I mean, we have to protect and control this organization. I mean, as we've learned over the years, every generation wants to not do what the last generation did. So maybe we can make some real change here.
Affect
and some things differently. And for boys to get back to asking girls out on dates instead of using apps to do that would be terrific. So.
I think that all the times that I was crushingly rejected growing up were very important for my upbringing.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure it is. It's good. But yeah, you still live to tell the tale. So.
Yeah. I'm still living. But
I just kind of stood there and hoped girls would ask me out. So
did that work?
No, it didn't. Okay. But it must have worked out in the long term because wonderful wife.
That's so true. yeah, my dad figured out the perfect way to make sure I didn't date, and he taught me and my brothers how to play Dungeons and Dragons. So that was pretty much kept us out of the dating pool.
I'm sure you know there's plenty of girls out there who want to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Not that we knew. It was all everyone that we knew was, you know, that we played D&D with was covered in a thin layer of Cheeto dust. So, but it worked. So anyway, tangent. Thank you guys for listening in again, John. Thank you for coming in and talking about this. This is again, want to reiterate, this is not something he's charging for. It's not something he's trying to make money off of. It's just it truly is to get the message out there. So yeah, if you are interested, reach out on our website. We'd love to get that set up. So, thank you all for joining us, and we will see you next time. Bye.